As an added benefit to reoccurring donors, we are sending out DCO face masks to any monthly contributors for 3 months or more at the $5 plus level. Please send your size preference, either large or youth or small size, along with membership email and mailing address to info@dcontario.org. And you can check out what they look like in the show notes.
This podcast was specifically created for Distress and Crisis Ontario organizations and their volunteer responders to provide training and educational assistance on a variety of topics. As information evolves and changes, these podcasts are meant to offer ongoing support with the goal of updating them on an ongoing basis. We thank the volunteer responders and the contributors to this podcast. Please visit our website, dcontario.org, for more information and how to access free mental health services. Thank you.
Manager for Distress and Crisis Ontario, and this week I am happy to once again introduce Hannah and Jesse, friends of DCO, as they share their unique perspectives on racism and diversity with us. If you have not listened to their previous podcast, Jazzy's Story, which we released on June 28th, 2021, I would highly recommend you do so to gain some added context to the conversation they have today. You can absolutely listen to this one first and then go back to the first one to learn more, or go and listen to it now and then come back here. Either way, I hope that you enjoy listening to Hannah and her gran as they discuss these challenging topics together.
Good morning. My name is Hannah. I'm a friend of Distress and Crisis Ontario. And this morning, I have the honor and privilege of sitting down to have a conversation with my gran, whose name is Jassy Narayan. Today, we've been invited by Distress and Crisis Ontario to share our insights on the topics of racism and diversity. So to begin, maybe we should both share a bit about ourselves and the perspectives we bring to this conversation. So Gran, tell me about your perspective in this conversation about racism. First, and maybe a bit about your identity, kind of.
Well, first I'd like to say that as a person who emigrated to Canada when your mother was 15 months old and her sisters were 2 or 3 and 5, I have come to accept I have multiple identities.
Yeah.
My identity in Guyana was shaped by the whole process of decolonization. The country, as I was growing up, I was born the year the World War was declared in 1938. And by the middle of the 1940s, Guyana was mesmerized by the work Gandhi and Nehru were doing to decolonize India, which began the process of decolonization of British colonies. So I grew up in that kind of a milieu. In the house I grew up in, a very well-to-do house of my aunt and my uncle and their adult children, there was a little magazine in the house called Young India. I could have been 10, and I learned the word sedition when I was little, because the conversation in the house was this magazine was smuggled into Guyana illegally, and anybody with the magazine could be in trouble. So I had this vision of somebody coming to do harm with this.
Right.
But what later on, by age 15, 16, I was well into what was going on in decolonization. So that's an identity that shaped my growing up. It wasn't that the World War had ended. It was that India was going to take apart an empire.
Yeah, that's a pretty significant
Huge identity. And Churchill was not a hero of the process.
Right, absolutely.
Hero wanted to know why this upstart little man, I forgot what he called Gandhi, a half-naked fakir. A fakir is a madman, I think.
Right.
How dare he say that in there should be independent, that India would be nothing without Britain. Mm-hmm. So that's my child. That's my adolescence. And what that identity did is stimulate the love of reading.
Mm-hmm.
I was reading Decolonization before I was reading 17 magazine on girls' fashion from America. That's a huge identity.
How do you find your identity as a racialized person changed once you immigrated to Canada?
Well, the immigration itself in 1966, three things I thought I would touch on. We were, the neighborhood had never seen Indians.
Right. Yeah, so, my mom always describes growing up around a lot of white neighbors in Kitchener. Lovely people, right. But all white.
So what we were approved. We had a high approval rating.
Right.
The kids were stunningly beautiful.
Yeah.
Your grandfather dressed like a magazine from Italy. And I was an outgoing person. I was the one knocked on doors and said stuff. Acceptance came much later. And acceptance was always, for me, qualified because my identity from Guyana was never a discussion point. Maybe the food from Guyana, but not its political And nobody I met in the Canadian-born white community had so much privilege that they didn't even know there was colonization.
Yeah, absolutely.
I had no idea. So the identity, reaching out to schools and the stuff that came in the late 70s with Pakiism in the 70s and 80s, when there was some disease going around here called Pakiism, is a term imported from Britain, where my colleague I worked with at the region said to me, I don't want you to come to my house ever to pick me up, because my son said, we got away from the stinking Pakis in England, please don't bring them here to the house. That scared the daylights out of me. I was so scared.
I never knew that story. That's
I
insane.
Told my friend, can I pick you up at the street corner? Because you imagine a racist person harming you, right? That's a living image for racialized people.
Yeah.
So she was very lovely, kind. We worked together. But that the Pakiism was so strange because I would be driving down and somebody would hold their nose. And the holding the nose was about smelling stinking spices from Pakis.
Oh, my goodness.
That was a done thing. But anyway, that did not deter people making friends with me, or my motivation to outreach and be socially competent. So I always said we were approved, we were a wonderful curiosity, and we were the stage of being exotic. Have you met that Indian
family? That
word,
family? Exotic, yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. They have the cutest baby, and that baby was your mother. I could have charged fees for people to see, because she was the perfect baby to stroll out with.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so that the early life was racializing. It's the bulk of visible minority immigrants came later in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, for sure.
So I went through the stages. There was a school teacher that put masking tape over your Aunt Davika's mouth because she loved to talk and raise her hand. She had answers for things. And the other thing, the public health nurse in the 60s who was coming to look at visible minority, this was before the influx, to search the head of little children to see if they had lice.
Yeah.
So my daughter, Sabrina, had a braid right down to her bum, and the nurse came, took the braid apart. I thought this is a strange custom that a nurse comes anyway. So those were how this cultural collision was beginning.
Yeah.
That really became stuff in by the 90s. And
yeah. I grew up in such a different Canada, I think, than my mom and my aunts grew up in. Just to share, I guess, a bit of perspective about where I'm coming from. I'm 21 years old. I'm a Canadian-born Canadian citizen. I've always identified as being biracial because my mom, who's my grand's daughter, she's brown Canadian with these Indo-Caribbean roots, and my dad is a white Canadian, and his roots, ancestral roots, are in Great Britain. So I look very racially ambiguous because I have this kind of caramel-colored skin and brown hair and brown eyes, and a lot of the time people see me and they don't know what to do with me. Some of the more outgoing people, they'll look at me and they'll start guessing ethnicities, right? They'll say, oh, are you Italian? Or they'll start speaking Spanish to me. And I haven't decided yet whether I like it or not when people guess, but sometimes people don't guess. They just sort of see me and they make decisions in their head about where I fall on the racial spectrum. And it's a bit different, I think, than the world my mom grew up in, because back then it was so much more, I don't know, it was so much more racist, and people weren't having the kind of conversations that we're having now.
And I think in the early years, I experienced tremendous kindness.
Yeah.
From neighbors in my apartment. And even in the 66 to 72, I was championed by three amazing Canadian-born white women of privilege.
Mm-hmm.
And what I learned is, in my social work career, that white privilege is a wonderful asset that could be used to change the world we all live in. And I experienced
Absolutely. That. Yeah. White privilege is real.
It's real, but it could be you. I have taught social work students who are white how to, don't wonder if you have it. It's a given.
Yeah.
Your skin gives you that. It's your path. How do you use that then in the interest of people who have no power and no privilege? But I learned it from those ladies who decided that I was worthy and of championing, and those three who never knew each other but knew me showed me how to be educated. One employed me, two of the, so my racialized identity has been on a continuum. For all the 55 years.
Right, because you were accepted by these people with this white privilege.
Yeah. You see, so from being approved, they didn't do the approval as much as they said they recognized some strengths, and they wanted to promote those strengths using the privilege they had.
Yeah.
Right? So that was maybe a miracle in my life.
Yeah.
But my life continued.
Work to your advantage, I guess.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's funny because I'm not white, but I experience white privilege too. Because people, when they see me, they don't know what to make of me. So when by assuming that I'm white and I don't have this half of me that came from Guyana many years ago, by just assuming I'm white, I have the same privileges that white people experience. And I think this kind of leads into my next question. Why do you think it's important to celebrate and promote diversity? Why do you think it's important to have conversations like this about people's
roots? I've spent a lot of reflection on that question, Hannah, because for my social work career, it became really important. I graduated with a degree in social work in 87. and with an early childhood diploma 10 years before that. So my formal education took 17 years, going to school, nighttime, weekends, throughout the summer. But I found that Canada, my profession and my colleagues, use the word diversity as a cop-out for acceptance.
Interesting.
And the way that I had a friend, a colleague from India who practices in Toronto, labeled it, that the preoccupation with diversity, she labeled as saris, samosas, and sandals. She said, once you stay with those three, diversity is wonderful. Then consciousness radically changed. I mean, people used to go to classes, pay hundreds of dollars to learn something, which I thought was absurd, is they were going to learn cultural competency.
Right.
And I resisted that because it had nothing to do with inclusion.
Right. When was this that these conversations were happening? What years?
In my, let me see, I graduated in it. By the 90s, it was rife.
Right. Okay.
Every social worker in the 90s would be, have you been to a cultural competency? So the shock came when these conceptual words always get me, because as a social work practitioner, my work was to transform a concept into observable behavior.
Right.
And I knew that there was no inclusion.
Yeah.
So when inclusion became a fancy word, how are we going to be inclusive? Then the society married the word diversity with inclusion.
Right. So conversations about diversity were happening prior to conversations about inclusion.
And it really allowed a level of complacency
in
people who had leadership responsibilities to just ignore their hiring practices.
Yeah.
And those realities, what do you call it? My worldview always knew it was false. But I had nowhere. I was a little brown social worker, wasn't about to shock any boats, until I became executive director of the provincially funded Better Beginnings program.
Yes.
And that gave me my role and my practice and my values and my principles came together.
Yeah.
Was a wonderful highlight of a aging lady. So in recently, I think Canada is in a bit of a stew pot with three things that have happened. COVID, the pandemic, a whole bunch of old people like me dying in nursing homes. Shocked me that this is the country where we say we love old people. Was the other is the prime minister with the death of the black man in Minneapolis and finding of their children buried without whatever that thing is. Three things, and the prime minister saying to Canada, we are a systemically racist country.
Right.
And I thought, is this enlightenment? Because now the RCMP lady can't continue to say, but we're not systemically racist, because she's in the saris and samosa and sandal phenomena. She goes to she eats pita bread and hummus, and she really thinks she's culturally inclusive.
Right, so not inclusion, it used to be kind of like a performative thing. Like if you go to one Indian wedding, you can say, oh, I'm not racist, I have an Indian friend.
And I have great puris.
The
puris were delicious. So what happened is, in Better Beginnings, that is, I use methodology from social work, practices in social work, and skills, competent social development skills, to integrate my neighbor, and with support from the ministry, who said, you must make the neighbor your every part of your program looked like this neighborhood.
Right.
Well, the neighborhood was 33% brown from Vietnam and all of Afghanistan. And that methodology did something that the city of Guelph had never seen before, is brown people, I always say the cinnamon and clove and all those lovely colors, sapodilla, everybody was in the same center.
Yeah.
And had to make it work. So teaching staff, hiring diverse people. I think we had a small staff, but the people who were no immigrants spoke 15 different languages.
Mm-hmm.
So they could. So what I realized that it is, maybe go to your next question.
Well, what did you realize? Just wrap this up.
Yeah, I realized a vacuum in leadership in organizations. I don't know. The corporate sector was doing great, while social work leaders, mental health leaders, were liking diversity and being really complacent. The corporate sector was giving you rice, 10 kinds of rice in the grocery store, because they learned that we buy rice we buy different kinds of rice. Funeral homes were burying us in different rituals because we could pay.
Right.
But it was the social, educational, and mental health network that remained complacent.
Right. I think kind of what I'm understanding is like it was profitable to not be racist and to be inclusive. Like corporations could make money off of selling all these kinds of rice. But when it came right down to educating people in school about how important it is to promote inclusion and be actively anti-racist, that was not happening.
No, and I called it, you know, people would say it's frontline workers. First, I hate the word frontline because it's a military term.
That's true.
The soldiers you kill first. So I called my colleagues direct service worker because the language of social work is quite militant.
Yeah.
It is very militant. We borrow the words of care from the army.
Yeah.
So the leadership, the people in leadership roles right into my time into Better Beginnings were still complacent.
Yeah.
Inclusion has to be measurable
and
observable. And the irony is, if we are visible minorities, how come you don't count us? Like, how do you visibility become invisible? I mean, it's quite a conundrum.
Yeah.
But now there is some kind of energy going on about how black people have been. I mean, Trudeau saying we do have a history of slavery is really what I learned two words in the newspaper today, is putting holes into the complacency of Canadians.
Right.
So you don't have to wonder if you were racist. You just have to acknowledge that you were a colony that did horrible things to Indigenous people and did not recognize that you left Black Canadians out of most prosperous circles.
Yeah, this word complacency, I wonder if there were a person out there who thought they were being complacent with the racism that happens in this country, and if this person were also looking to be more culturally intelligent and act as an ally for people who experience racism, what would you say to this person to help them be less complacent and be more of an ally?
Well, I have a young colleague who left Kitchener-Waterloo recently to work in the Peel Board, and he is doing some work on inclusion and diversity. And something I learned from a paper he published, and your Auntie Sabrina works with the Peel Board, is if educators would begin not with the denial that I'm not racist, but I've come from a racist history, I've come from this, just acknowledge that so that you could move on, what do we do now?
Right, instead of just denying, it's more important to accept where you are.
Because it's undeniable.
Yeah.
And so you move on. So what do teachers need to learn is what he's hopefully teaching the Peel Board, is I think we are all at a stage, you have this acknowledgement from the Trudeau and some other people. So where do we, how do we chart the future? Mm-hmm. And risk-taking with privilege, with power, is a wonderful skill set. Mm-hmm. So executive directors have to feel uncomfortable in order to be teach the rest of us.
Absolutely.
Right? Team leaders have, and before we get all confused with who's hijab and who doesn't have, it's trivializing the issue. Mm-hmm. It's get with leadership. How do you teach inclusion and teamwork? And we have great skills. I always say Canada's done that with Europeans who are not from the British Isles. Mm-hmm. Right? They had to accept these Europeans and Russian and German. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We already know how to do that. Practice it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, acceptance is, I think it's very important. I've thought a lot about my own identity in the last year in the wake of all these conversations about race. And because I've never, as a biracial person, it's hard to identify 100% with either side.
Because
it's not like I experience 50% of what my mom experiences and 50% of what my dad experiences as a white man. I experience 100% of my own experiences.
Yeah. And that makes you unique. Yeah. Because neither parent has your experience.
Yeah, and I think I grew up with that misconception that they do. Like, my dad would understand half my experience. Yes. But it's not half, because I have my own unique experiences. I go out and get asked if I speak Spanish. And neither of my parents has that happen to them.
But you also had to chart a place for yourself in the society.
Yeah.
Right, mm-hmm. As a student. And we could learn, you know, there are people who say, how do you interrupt a conversation that always saying, where are you from? Mm-hmm. You could say, you're Canadian, mm-hmm. of culturally diverse heritage.
Yeah, it goes back to the multiple identities thing.
It goes back to context. Mm-hmm. Context is important. In which context do you get, I do a lot of talking to white students about their discomfort and how they feel about where they are in their, so one young student said, I really want to understand the hijab.
Right.
And I said, well, I'll advise you, don't ask anybody in a grocery store. It's likely to misfire.
Misconstrued. Yeah.
Pick your context. You have to know somebody, you know, as well as you know me.
Yeah.
And then you say to somebody with respect that I would love to learn more. And I said, hijabs vary across the world. Mm-hmm. No two are alike. Well, maybe two are alike. But there are ways to be respectful in what we want to learn, and invasive won't work.
Yeah, there's definitely a difference between having a respectful conversation with someone about like ethnic background, but also having an invasive and inappropriate conversation.
Right. So then I say, be smart to context.
Right.
That's social work prepares you with a range of communication tools. Learn when to use them. Mm-hmm. And how, and find sympathetic teachers to guide you, you know. And if you make a mistake, the world doesn't end.
I
had a friend, a colleague, and a Muslim man refused to shake her hand. Mm-hmm. And she was devastated. And I said to her, you're devastated because one person didn't shake your hand? Get real. Right? Maybe you all learn to say namaste, put your hands together. And so don't be devastated because that's how privilege works.
Yeah.
It says everything should meet your standard.
And, right.
But I said to her, don't worry over it. It's just one person.
Yeah, I think going in with an attitude of respect towards people of backgrounds you don't understand is so important.
Exactly. And ask, you know, in this multicultural society, there are people you could ask about norms and rituals and stuff.
And that's okay, I think. Like, I don't I don't really mind being asked, like, even when, like, I think it's kind of funny when people, funny and also kind of inappropriate when people ask me if I'm Italian or Spanish, but I do appreciate their curiosity, because yeah. then I can tell them, well, actually, I'm half Indo-Guyanese and half, you know, British way back, and I'd rather have that conversation than, and have them be curious than have them say something ignorant.
And context again.
Yeah.
You will know if the context is hostile or
exactly,
if it's
yeah.
friendly.
I'm very lucky in my upbringing. I don't think I've ever experienced blatant racism, but that's not been my mom's experience. I know that's not
right.
been your experience or granddad's
right.
experience. So I do wonder, maybe just to wrap things up, if there were a person who had experienced racism, what would you suggest as a support to this person?
Well, because of my social work skills,
yeah.
I face that. I Ama Savin, my piece of Ama Savin, now I describe as a Canadian village. I live in a village that's multiple race, multiple ethnicities and people from, so people talk to me about this.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing I would say, I want to understand, is everybody in your family safe?
Okay.
Safety
yeah.
is important. Does a person feel somebody will burn their house down or attack them or
yeah.
their mosque? Or do you feel safe?
Yeah.
And the other thing is, what is this issue? I have a very broad network. If somebody, I learned in from a mentor, if a person is threatened, life is threatened, you need the police.
Yeah.
If somebody's wife tells me she's beaten up, she needs a shelter.
Mm-hmm.
And if you are very sick, you need a hospital.
Yeah.
That's part of helping people get what. And other than that, you could call somebody in the network, whether it's the working center is a wonderful place.
Yeah.
To say to somebody, I know the manager at the working center. I want you to go, and they will help you with this problem.
Yeah.
They are the multicultural center or the
yeah.
reception house. Those
yeah.
are activists, people mm-hmm. who work on these issues daily. So I never feel helpless.
Yeah, because there are lots of supports available that you've been able to identify.
Right, right. Somebody feels a professor did this, then you call somebody head of the department to say,
yeah.
could you please meet with this person? There's a story here I think you could listen to be helpful.
Yeah. I think this goes back to what we were talking about in the last podcast we recorded when you said there's always someone to help.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's my belief. And so I control the request. I don't control the answer.
Right.
So somebody's asking me for something. How do I respond? And I'm really well connected.
Mm-hmm.
I know that as an going to be 84-year-old lady.
Yeah.
I'm connected in my community.
What would you say to someone who's not quite as well connected, who's experienced racism? How do they go about finding those connections?
I don't know. I don't know how a person...
Maybe it starts with just connections within your family, within your school.
Or the people who approach me, or somebody approaches me on behalf of somebody else. But I know that there are places, churches,
yeah.
are very empathetic to people suffering racial oppression.
Mm-hmm.
But who is to tell the person that? I don't know. I only know in my own sphere. And when I had the opportunity to teach social workers, what could be their narrative? What are they learning? The ones placed at the multicultural center. If a student is placed there, their experience of how to practice your skills in inclusion is a wonderful place, because agencies are really in this town really to help. But your question is, what if a person, I guess you just go through the terror of being attacked as a racialized person.
I guess, but that's probably if you don't reach out to anyone. That's if you just internalize and don't open up to anyone about your experience.
I think so. I think this thing about there is always help.
Yeah.
Your teacher would be helpful. The guy in the grocery store would be helpful.
Yeah.
But you know, we hear about all the racism going on. We now know it's a racial, what is it Trudeau said? Every Canadian system is, what is the word he called? Systemic racism. Everyone, education, policing, healthcare. So that Canadians could take to heart as a given, because I think the optimism is, where do we go from here?
Yeah, he's done that piece you talked about of acceptance. He's not trying to deny that we're not a racist society. He's saying we are racist, whatever problems you have with Trudeau.
Right.
Well, acceptance is where you start, I think.
Acceptance of your history.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The history. And it's significant that this turmoil of putting, interrupting your complacency, interrupting it with new history. The impetus has come from Black people, where the guy got murdered by police, right on primetime TV.
Yeah, George Floyd.
And the Native people with up state-of-the-art technology, looking under the ground where their kids are buried. Mm-hmm. They did that. So these two oppressed groups are leading the way.
Yeah.
And we are fantastic. Responding.
Yeah.
And the government is responding, and hopefully faculties are responding. We can't fight our way through this.
Yeah.
You know, fighting doesn't work. Somebody ends up being killed. It's education and dialogue, risk-taking.
Yeah.
If you have some privilege, and you do, skin color is a wonderful privilege, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Just use it. And that has happened in my experience. You know, a minister's wife decided she was going to be my champion for how to be a volunteer, how to be a church participant. Parishioner.
Yeah, I think that's a good lesson for going back to our other question about maybe white people who are looking to be less complacent, maybe using your privilege for a good reason.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you have it. You know, I told a student one time, if you pick up the phone, somebody's telling you that his whole family is harassed because they're Muslim, and you talk to your supervisor here, and the AD of the Multicultural Center is an amazingly skilled advocate. You take it up, you go to her, and then a phone call, and locate yourself, your name, you're a student of this university, and this is what I'm doing here, and this is a situation I'm dealing with, and I'd like this person to come to your office. All those things are practices of inclusion.
Right. So if you observe racism, you can always take it somewhere.
And I say to students, you can't afford to be helpless.
Yeah. Yeah.
You are the door that this person has, and you have the skills. I love to say to social work students, social workers are the best positioned.
That's true.
Because we get to learn practices. Mm-hmm. Right, get out of your head and stop talking about empowerment. What is, until I could observe what you mean, it stays a word in your head.
Yeah, absolutely. Gran, I want to thank you for sitting down with me today. I learned a lot of things, and I hope people who are listening learn some things too.
Well, I loved it that we each could start the process of...
Yeah, I think this is, conversations like this are where the good things happen.
I think so. And equity and inclusion and diversity is a given. You could go and eat your samosas anywhere.
Yeah.
And now the latest is, what's the thing Uncle Jeff likes?
Shawarma.
Shawarma. You said, shawarma doesn't burn. It's wonderful. It doesn't have all that Indian spice from Guyana to make your life miserable. Shawarma is wonderful. So we know all that about that. Get ready with inclusion.
Yeah.
In your classroom and in your wherever.
Yeah, I agree. Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. Please remember that if you ever need support or would like help finding resources, you can reach out to any of our member centers by finding their contact information on our website at www.dcontario.org/locations, or to access the ONTX text or online chat program any day of the week between the hours of 2 p.m. to 2 a.m., you can text SUPPORT to 258-258 or click Chat Now on our website's homepage. We hope you enjoyed this week's podcast and hope you join us next week as we continue discussing racism and cultural intelligence.
Hi, I'm Damien, one of the editors of the DCO Learning Forums podcast. We are committed to providing the most current and up-to-date information. With your help, we can make it better. Please consider going to tips.pinecast.com/jar/distress-and-crisis-ontario.com or by clicking the link in the show notes. And by donating, monthly contributors will be able to access a special podcast feed. In it, we'll have additional content and some more in-depth pieces on some of our most popular topics. Thank you.